The committee will come to order. Good morning, everybody. Seeing how we do not have a quorum, in the interest of time, this being an informational hearing, we will begin. Members, as you know, the subcommittee will be holding an informational meeting today. We will hear several presentations lasting approximately 10 to 15 minutes each. At the end of each presentation, we will allow a short period for discussion and member questions. Does anybody have any questions today? All right. Well, I thought it would be helpful to start by getting an update from the OLA on the status of the special review that was initiated back in May to focus on widespread fraud in the Child Care Assistance Program, otherwise known as CCAP. As late as October, we had expected a report to be delivered sometime this month, this December, and it appears that report due this month was just a bit optimistic. So here to tell us more about the special review is Legislative Auditor Jim Nobles. Mr. Nobles, thank you for coming to the testifying table. If you would please identify yourself for the record and proceed when ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, and with me is Elizabeth Stawicki, and she is working with me on our special review of the Child Care Assistance Program. Madam Chair and members, let me just set a little bit of context. We call this a special review, and I sometimes use this as the best joke I have. We call them special because we weren't planning on doing them. In other words, we had a full agenda for this year, and we were working on that. And then there were allegations about fraud in the CCAP program, and we felt compelled to open an investigation. We are the auditor of state government and the state's use of both federal and state funds. And so we felt we had an obligation under the law to get to the bottom of the allegations that were being made. I will say that concern about fraud in the Child Care Assistance Program is not new. In fact, there is a long history of reports that have pointed out the vulnerability of this program to fraud. And there are cases that have been prosecuted that have proven fraud is in this program. But I think that the allegations that were made earlier this year by Mr. Stillman, and you're going to be hearing from him, added visibility and urgency to the concern about fraud in the CCAP program. Therefore, we opened two reviews. We had financial auditors go over and look again at some of the financial controls. Again, I would reference the fact that we already know from previous reports that there are gaps and weaknesses in internal financial controls over this program. So we want to go back over, have been over, investigating those, examining those. The second review that we launched, and this is the one that Ms. Stawicki and I are working on, we're looking very directly at the allegations. We are looking to see if we can find facts to substantiate the allegation that the level of fraud in the CCAP program in Minnesota may approach $100 million or more annually. We are also looking for facts to substantiate the allegation that some of the CCAP fraud money is being used to fund terrorist organizations in foreign countries. We are also looking at concerns that have been raised about how Mr. Stillman was treated when he was an employee at DHS. One senator has alleged that Mr. Stillman was fired for coming forth with his allegations. We are looking into that. We are also looking into allegations that officials at DHS have interfered with CCAP investigations, interfered inappropriately. So that is the scope of what we're doing. Let me tell you just a little bit about how we go about these kinds of special reviews. Frankly, the way we go about all of our work, because whatever it is, an audit, an investigation, a special review, our goal is the same, and that is to find the facts and present them as accurately, objectively, and fairly as we can. So conduct these two reviews. and I'll speak very specifically about the one Mr. Wickie and I are working on. We are reviewing a great many documents. We are looking within the department. We're looking at any and every kind of report that we can find that is relevant. And some of the documents most relevant are the court records that have proven fraud. And so we are looking very closely at those. We are also interviewing people who've been involved in those prosecutions. We are interviewing investigators. We are interviewing officials at DHS. And you might wonder, well, what is our authority and how far can we go in this kind of investigation? Our authority is broad and it's deep, thanks to you, the legislature. People are required under the law to cooperate with us. If they don't, we can subpoena them. We have authority to review all documents, regardless of their classification. So no one can hide anything from us. If they try, again, we will subpoena those documents. We are also going to put together two reports of the findings in both of these areas. I think at this point the financial audit report will be separate from the report that Mr. Wickie and I are working on. But if possible, because they relate to a similar subject, we'll bring them together. But we are working on this as expeditiously as possible. As the chair indicated, back in the spring, I was optimistic and said we would be able to finish this by around this time. But frankly, as we've gotten into these issues, we have seen their complexity, we have seen their sensitivity, we have seen that we need to talk to a lot of people. And we are continuing to do that. Our work, our field work, our investigative work is not done. We will continue to interview people. We will continue to look at documents until we're satisfied that we know everything that is to be known about these allegations, and we can present you with a report. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Members, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles and Ms. Stawicki. Mr. Nobles, you mentioned interference, or that your audit process has somehow been obstructed. I'd like to find out a little more about why you made that reference.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, let me be clear. I was not saying that our review has been interfered with. What we are looking at is whether or not DHS officials have interfered in investigations within the Department of Child Care Facilities. But to the best of my knowledge, we have experienced no interference in our work. And again, if we sense that we are not getting the documents, not getting the cooperation that we need, we will issue a subpoena to whoever we think is interfering or not cooperating.
Ms. Stawicki, I'll pose a question to you. And Mr. Nobles mentioned that your audit has expanded beyond just the scope that was initially intended to now include not only statewide but probably countywide and municipal. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to the legal process of going through those various elected boards and elected agencies. How do you go about that process?
As far as the county prosecutors, I mean, we've simply just gone through court documents that have to do with prosecutions of CCAP fraud cases in different counties, and then we've also been talking with prosecutors, both state and federal, as well, and just making inquiries.
For either one of you, you mentioned, Mr. Nobles, that this is a special review, but you made careful note to not call it an investigation. What is the difference? When does it trip over into one or the other?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think the two terms are reasonably synonymous. I think I call them special reviews because there's a category of work that we do that sometimes is not necessarily focused on allegations of misuse of public resources. We, if you look at our website, we have documents that we do call investigations. I would be comfortable calling this one an investigation. It is an investigation of alleged misuse of public resources. Now, typically, when we conduct an investigation and call it an investigation, we are investigating the people that who are alleged to have misused the resources. So, for example, we have on occasion received information that a public employee, a nonprofit organization, was misusing public funds. In those cases, we contact law enforcement, and we work out an arrangement by which either we will proceed or we will defer to them. We are not a criminal investigative organization, so we need to be in coordination with law enforcement. And if we go forward with their understanding, that could be with either state or federal law enforcement organizations, we conduct an investigation. We issue subpoenas. We put people under oath. And sometimes the facts that we find do lead to criminal prosecutions. And we turn that information over to the appropriate legal authorities, be that the FBI, the U.S. Attorney, or county attorney's offices. And we've done that on occasion in the past. And we will do that in this case if we find evidence that suggests the possibility of criminal activities by individuals. We have an obligation to do that in the law, and that's what we do.
Mr. Nobles, you mentioned that you will continue to interview people that are material or otherwise affected by this review. Are you finding that anyone is hesitant to participate in this review?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, members, yes. People are very reluctant because we are talking to them about very sensitive matters and asking them about information, much of which is classified as not public. And we have to work out arrangements whereby they are comfortable that we have the authority to ask them questions and see documents that reveal not public information, and that we have an obligation to protect that. And we have, to the best of my recollection, always reached that understanding with people, whether they are prosecutors, investigators, or others, that they have an obligation to give that information to us, and we have an obligation to protect it. We also have authority in law to protect their identity. And some people that we interview do want their identity protected. They do not want us to disclose that we interviewed them, or certainly that we provide information that would identify them. So those are the conditions under which we sometimes have to interview people who are reluctant.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. Didn't realize you'd get to me that quick. Thank you for your work, Mr. Nobles, and I want to make sure I get the name pronounced correctly. Miss
Stawicki.
Stawicki, thank you. So a couple of things that I'm just curious about as I'm listening. You've done, and Mr. Nobles, you've done lots of investigations, and I'm sure there's patterns and behaviors that can be common in many of these. Are any of those patterns or show red flags as to that there's something maybe deeper or not? Are you seeing any of those? Does that exist?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha and members, I think one of the things that is a little bit different in this case is that, as I mentioned, there is already a well-established record that there is fraud in this program. We sometimes have conducted investigations into programs or the use of money by particular individuals where there isn't that kind of record already established. So it's very helpful that we know, frankly, from the court records what the general scheme is for the fraud. And so that is a pattern that we have in this case that we don't always have. A new element, of course, is that this money may be used for purposes overseas to support terrorism. We certainly have found information in the past that we turned over either to the FBI or to Homeland Security or both if we thought that that was a concern. But I think the thing that makes this different is that it is such a known allegation. Oftentimes when we have done investigations, there was no one making an allegation, such as Mr. Stillman, that the fraud is supporting terrorism. But any time we uncover any evidence that we think has any link to terrorist organizations, we turn that information over to the FBI and or that includes with the U.S. Attorney, of course, or the Department of Homeland Security. So I'd say, just off the top of my head, those are two elements that make this a little bit different.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Mr. Nobles, just to follow up on that, so when you say it's a little bit different, and I'll make sure I characterize your comments correctly, would you say that difference could be defined as more serious than other investigations you've done?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, yes. I mean, anytime there is an allegation of this magnitude, both in terms of the dollar amount and in terms of connections to international terrorism, that makes it all the more serious, more sensitive. But I would just say we've investigated organizations that defrauded the state out of $10,000. To me, that's not correct, that's serious, and we will go after that as well. And if it proves, or if we cannot substantiate that the level of fraud is $100 million, if it's $50 million, if it's, frankly, any amount of money, the state needs to take that seriously. We need to take that seriously. We need to find ways to prevent fraud as well as go after people who perpetrate it. And that will be part of what we will try to report to you. Not only how good a job are we doing catching, investigating, prosecuting people who defraud the state, but how can we do a better job of preventing it?
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nobles. You mentioned four allegations, and thank you for laying those out, allegations that this may approach $100 million, allegation that it may be used to fund terrorist activity, allegations that certain employees may have been treated poorly, or there's been, they've been treated poorly, and allegations that DHS may have not been as cooperative with the investigation. I won't use the word interfering. I'll say it that way. Is, at this time, do you believe there's any evidence that would show any of those four allegations don't have merit?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Kreisha, I cannot disclose that at this time, at this place.
Can you give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
No, ma'am. No,
sir. Okay. So I'll take that as they're still active and understood. Okay. Madam Chair?
Representative Kreisha.
Just a couple more, Mr. Nobles. Why so long? You're usually very good with your timelines. You're very good with how you predict things. I've worked with your office in the past, and you're very diligent. Why are you missing your timelines? Why do you think this one has gone on longer than anticipated?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Kreisha, several reasons. One, as I said, it was not on our schedule. We had to set aside other work. And that made it difficult to assemble the team. We also have about probably 15 or 16 other audits and valuations, special reviews in process, and I have to be involved in all of those, not as deeply and directly as I am in this one, but those take time. Mr. Wicke also has other responsibilities. So it's just the level of ongoing work, and the other reason, as I said, once we got into this, we realized that there were a lot of people. We have talked to a lot of county attorneys, for example. We've talked to a lot of law enforcement people. Sometimes we go to where they are. That takes time. I would like to have the report out sooner rather than later, frankly, so I could turn my attention to some of the other things that we have ongoing. I might say, for example, while we were doing this special review, Ms. DeWicke and I were finishing a review that the legislature asked for, the use of fetal tissue in research at the University of Minnesota, another very complicated, sensitive subject. And so we will be issuing the results of that report on Thursday. So we were having to work on that simultaneous with this special review.
Just three more.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just as a quick follow-up to that, so would it be fair to say that with all of your load and with everything that you're trying to accomplish, if DHS were to cooperate and work freely with you in an expedited manner, that would be helpful to getting this out?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Crescia, I really don't have complaints about DHS and their cooperation. It is really on us more to dig through the documents. Another one comes to mind that you may be aware of that we're working on and we'll have some reports on recently that I've had to be involved with recently to some degree, and that is the situation with Menlars. We have four reviews of the problems with Menlars. I have had some of those reports released, but we continue to work on those. And departments, and I say that just because departments are used to working with us. As we speak, my guess is, could ask one of our staff, we have people down at DHS right now. We work with DHS continuously because of the volume of dollars they spend. We are currently the agent of the federal government under the Single Audit Act, auditing the state's use of federal funds by DHS and other agencies. So I think DHS has a history of understanding that they have to cooperate with us, and resistance is futile.
Last two.
All right, Representative Crescia.
And I'll just tie these together in one. You mentioned, Mr. Noble, that some of the information is not public knowledge. Is that sensitive about the recipients? And if it's not public, is it easier to be, or is there the opportunity to falsify that with less people knowing? I'll say it that way.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Crescia, you know, again, when we are dealing with people who have sensitive, not public information, particularly information that involves law enforcement and prosecutions, we have to be concerned and sensitive, and we have to satisfy them that they can trust us, that we have legal obligations. We certainly do not want to disclose anything that would harm an active law enforcement investigation. Or, frankly, there is information for investigations and prosecutions that are closed that still have information that is not public and under seal because of the nature of some of what was involved. And so we work with that. We sometimes ask judges to allow us to see material that is under seal. And so it's a matter of establishing a level of trust and understanding of who we are and what we do. We're not new to this. And so I've worked with many people in federal law enforcement and local law enforcement over the years, with the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, with county attorneys, and I think that most of them have that level of understanding. Sometimes there are new people who come into these offices that we have to work with. But at this point, I'm satisfied that we have gotten what we have asked for.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Crescia. Representative Albright, and then we're going to move on.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Knowles. Mr. Nobles, is there anyone that is immune to a subpoena from you?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Albright, that question has never been tested. I issue a subpoena because I believe they are subject to it. If they do not respond to the subpoena, my next option is to go to district court and get a court order to compel their compliance with the subpoena. If they do not comply with the court order, they can be held in contempt of court. To a judge, I have to, though, demonstrate that I'm acting within my authority and that I am pursuing a lawful investigation and that I need the information that I'm seeking. So ultimately, if there is resistance to a subpoena that I issue, I will have to go to court, and it will be in the hands of a judge to see if I have gone beyond my authority.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles, what is deemed being in compliance with a subpoena?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Albright, first of all, I always set a time and place in every subpoena to comply. If the subpoena requires you to come in and give answers and testimony under oath, compliance is being there at that appointed time and place. If I subpoena documents, I specify a time and place for delivery. Compliance is having the documents to me at that time and place.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And just to follow up on that, Mr. Nobles, put the representative in my head, though. Maybe you want to run for office someday, Mr. Nobles. Following up on what Representative Albright said, so let's say Joe was subpoenaed. For a line of questioning, and Joe just showed up to the meeting. He followed the subpoena. He showed up. Is he obligated to answer any of the questions, or just by showing up, does he fulfill the subpoena?
Madam Chair, he would comply by showing up. And I cannot compel people to stay in the room. I have no police powers. I cannot contain them. I cannot force them to waive their right to not say anything that is self-incriminating or to simply not answer the questions. So that is an option. I have had those kinds of situations, and it then rests on my persuasive ability to get the person to cooperate.
Okay.
And most of the time, but not always, I've been persuasive.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Nobles. And we look forward to seeing this report being done, but the other reports as well. I know my people back home and probably all across the state are excited about MNLARS, so we're looking forward to that too. Next up, I think it's important to hear from the individual who was critical in bringing all of this to our attention, here to remind us about how we got here, and to provide us an update, and his thoughts is Mr. Scott Stillman. He is the former manager of the state's Digital Forensics Lab. Mr. Stillman, please join us at the testifiers table and identify yourself for the record and proceed when ready.
My name is Scott Stillman. I was the former manager of the Department of Human Services Digital Forensics Lab. And appreciate you calling me here today. I wasn't really all that thrilled to be here, but when I became a police officer, I took an oath to defend this country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I was reminded of that recently. And I appreciate Mr. Noble's his investigation. I was listening to what he said there, and I appreciate the diligence and the direction he's taken. But I do feel that our nation's security is at risk because of what I brought to attention, and that's why I'm here today. So if you want to ask me some questions, that I'll do the best that I can for that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stillman, I watched the testimony that you gave before the Senate panel earlier this year. Fairly compelling. I think it raises a lot of questions. I think for the sake of this committee, I'm going to ask you maybe some questions, maybe just to review the activities and or the evidence that you saw during your time with your department, and then we can, I'd like to lead into a few other questions after that.
Go ahead, Mr. Stillman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, sure, that's fine. What would you like to ask me?
So what types of activities or evidence did you see in your investigation?
Again, in my role analyzing digital evidence, I would examine the computers, cloud storage, cell phones. I found a lot of the data on computers was basically there to appease or fulfill DHS requirements, but most of the evidence was on the cell phones. Wire transfers, money going overseas, multiple bank accounts, plans, instructions, money going to foreign countries, pictures of prominent people, things that really caused me great concern for the security of our nation and the CCAP program and the Medicaid fraud program.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
During your investigation, or now, can you provide verifiable evidence to support the claims that you made in that testimony?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, absolutely, yes. There are multiple witnesses who have documents and videos strongly supporting the evidence. And I would encourage Mr. Nobles to consider interviewing the 12 Office of Inspector General investigators and their supervisor managers. They have actual evidence. I've been gone for a year, so if you want current, you want reliable, you want verifiable, you want authoritative evidence of money going overseas, massive fraud, you have to talk to those people. And I would encourage Mr. Nobles to speak to those people independently without DHS supervisors present. I've been told that those people are under extreme duress right now. I've been told that they are under extreme harassment and retaliation, and they're afraid. They're afraid to speak right now. They're afraid for their jobs. They're afraid for their reputations. So you have to consider that these people are the number one source of evidence, and they're willing to speak to you, but they can't.
Mr. Stillman, did you write a detailed analysis of your report and your investigation?
Mr. Stillman?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I'm not sure I understand you.
Did you prepare a report based upon the investigation that you performed?
I've prepared a couple of reports, yes.
And who were they delivered to?
I prepared a fairly detailed report to the FBI, Minnesota FBI, and I copied it to Jeff Sessions.
And did you report or provide that report to anyone at DHS?
I did not.
May I ask why?
During our investigations, we found indications during seized bank records that indicated monies from the daycares under criminal investigation were providing monies two politicians, both Minnesota and federal is my understanding. And I didn't want those people alerted, so I went to the FBI. And that evidence exists. I gave the FBI the location of that evidence. I told them who was the custodian of that evidence. I told them that that money involved multiple people. And I wanted to keep it between myself and the FBI. I didn't want someone to destroy that evidence.
Madam Chair, Mr. Stillman, what is your present professional position?
Mr. Stillman.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I am unemployed seeking employment, which has been fairly difficult for me.
So you no longer work for the Office of Investigative General?
That is correct.
And when did you separate service?
Approximately March 4th, 2018.
Was that an amicable separation?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, no, it was not. I was under extreme duress. I was having my duties removed from me. I was demoted from my managerial position, and I was being, you can't imagine what it's like to have powerful people go after you. You're all alone, and you got some of the most powerful people in the world who use all their powers in the world to destroy you, and that's what they did to me. I couldn't take it anymore. I just resigned. I wasn't going to stay there anymore. It was the writing was on the wall that I was going to have to leave, so I just thought, and it's time to leave.
Have you requested any federal investigation other than what you've already declared closed?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yes, I did request the Department of Justice and Homeland Security to investigate. I gave them a report. I documented my reasons. I thought it was very detailed. And I did, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Stillman. Does any other members have questions for Mr. Stillman? Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question, Mr. Stillman. I'm curious. You mentioned money going to politicians or elected officials. Was that campaign contributions? Were you able to identify? And the only reason I ask is because that would certainly show up in a campaign finance report.
The individuals, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, the individuals who could give you that detailed information are willing to speak to you, but they are prevented from doing that at this time. If you wanted that information, I would strongly ask you to speak to the Office of Inspector General. There's 12 investigators. If they spoke to you about that, they could answer that question. I cannot answer that. I don't know if it was just money or contributions. But that evidence does exist. It has been preserved, and it is there for your review if you can get your hands on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. Does anybody else have any questions? Representative Albright?
Madam Chair, Mr. Stillman, you just said if you can get your hands on it. What would prevent either the OLA or some other federal law enforcement agency from getting their hands on it?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, this whole issue came about because an Office of Inspector General investigator, actually two investigators, put together a PowerPoint presentation to Minnesota law enforcement, state, local, federal, and it detailed in great detail the daycare CCAP fraud in Minnesota. This alarmed certain federal investigators, and that's how this came to light. To my knowledge, that PowerPoint presentation has been deleted or destroyed or withheld. I have not seen it, and no one can produce it at this point. So I would ask that you may want to pursue that, and it, if it's deleted on somebody's computer, it can be recovered. I would also say that a number of reports have been written, not by me, but from senior managers at DHS. Some of these reports have gone to the OLA. I would encourage you to get a copy of those. My understanding is some of the contents in some of those reports, the individual who drafted them was asked, demanded that he delete significant portions of it because it was too controversial. That individual is under incredible retaliation at this point, and this is verifiable. All you have to do is get a hold of these investigators and interview them. And they have not been interviewed to this point. And I would ask, I'm not a state employee anymore, I'm a taxpayer. These people stood up for something that was right, to defend our country, to defend our state, to do their job, the job that they were tasked with. And I appeal to you. Is there some way you can protect them? Is there anything you can do? I know we have a new administration coming in. I'd like to ask the new administration, are you going to protect these people? Can you promise the taxpayers that there's going to be transparency? We've had data and emails that have come to your desks, 12 pages that have been 12 pages, one paragraph, the rest redacted. What kind of transparency is that for our government, for the taxpayer? This has the potential to be Minnesota's Watergate. I stand by my allegations. I stand by my claims about the $100 million. It could potentially be higher than that. I stand by my claims that this money is going overseas into hands that are probably going to be very detrimental to the United States. I went to the FBI, I went to the Department of Justice, I went to the Homeland Security. I've got no reaction from them whatsoever. I don't understand why. So my appeal to you is, how are you going to protect those people from powerful people? I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I went off on a tangent there, but I apologize. So
it's okay. As a matter of fact, Mr. Stillman, the lieutenant-elect, Representative Peggy Flanagan, sits on this committee. As you can see, she is not here. However, we can offer to make a copy of the audio for her to listen to, so she can get filled in and carry your voice into the next administration. And I know she's very passionate about child care assistance, and I'm sure she's going to want to protect the integrity of that. And so I am hopeful with this new administration they will take the fraud seriously, because this is not going to be swept underneath the rug, people. We are going to continue working on that. I know my colleagues are very invested in making sure those who absolutely need the dollars, that those dollars are there for them. Mr. Stillman, can you just walk us through, though, how people steal and transfer money? I'm still trying to grasp how this happens. And this isn't just a Minnesota thing. All over the nation, child care assistance fraud is rampant. You can do just a simple Google search, and you've got tons of stories to choose from, many of which happen right here in Minnesota. I was just refreshing my memory about an individual a couple years ago, members here and the public. She stole, between her and her husband, with the child care, she had a child care business. Her husband had a they both had a home health care business. About $4 million were frauded. The arrests were made. There was a bail set for $1 million on the woman. And the argument was $1 million was too much. So it went down to a $200,000 to post. Some individuals believe that was just a little too high, that perhaps a flight risk could be at play. And you know what happened? She's nowhere to be found. Absolutely nowhere to be found. There is a movie, Enemy of the State, with Will Smith. Will Smith could not get very far without individuals knowing where he was. And I still am wondering how in today's world an individual who has defrauded the system by $4 million is just disappeared into thin air. But anyway, so if you could just walk us through that process of what you're seeing, maybe, you know, we can take some of that to the next legislative body and fix some of these issues.
Madam Chair, the daycare process typically requires that the provider of the daycare service keep some type of a log. Typically, it could be electronic, it could be paper. But we found that those are either not kept or that they're filled in, they're forged. We placed video cameras around these daycares, the front door, the back door, all the exits. And we've watched the videos. And I would encourage you, each of you, to go and see those videos. They're available at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in the Fusion Center, or some of the, particularly the adjudicated cases, you can see those. You'll see videos where the door is locked, the business is closed, and nobody comes. And then you look at the billing records, and they bill for 100 children. They'll bill on a Sunday. They'll bill on a holiday. They'll bill on days that they're closed. They may have 5 children. They may have 10, according to the video. And they'll bill for 80, 90 to 100. None of the cases we investigated were under $1 million. The laws and the statutes really need to be gone over. They're, I think, additionally, the Office of Inspector General needs to be removed from the Department of Human Services, because the people who are in controlling the process and the policies are the ones who are investigating them. That'd be like a police chief accused of misconduct investigating himself and then issuing a report that there's nothing wrong. How can you have any kind of credibility to that? The other issues are we've had cases. We've had cases where I have computers come in, cell phones from a search warrant. There's search warrants are on file. You can verify this. And then the investigators would come in, and they would say, there's a politician that got involved in this investigation, and we need the computers back, and we're going to go a different route. $18 million fraud. I checked the records. That business hasn't been shut down. They actually expanded. Another October 2016, search warrant executed. The individual had been convicted already, had a prior conviction, felony conviction. And I processed the computers, 30 computers and cell phones. I processed them. And when I tried to give the evidence to the investigator, he said, I can't accept that evidence. Well, why not? Because a very well-known, prominent politician told me I can't continue the investigation because that individual contributed to their campaign. And I checked, as of last week, the Hennepin County records on that. That individual has no convictions. And you can go and get those search warrants. And you can go get the police reports to verify that. And I can give you the names of the people, 5 witnesses who will verify this. Before I left, I was notified to prepare for a $34 million transportation fraud. That's part of CCAP. A $34 million transportation fraud. They told me it was going to be 5 cities. Massive. Gear up for it. Get ready. Recruit other investigators to help you because we're going to do the search warrant simultaneously. That search warrant never transpired. And I don't know why. And I don't know what reason it was for being shut down. But the Minnesota taxpayer pays for these programs. They deserve to have some transparency and accountability. When I was a police officer, I was warned almost every more frequently, you're going to have a massive amount of power. And you're going to have to be accountable for that. So when you go out and you have that kind of power, there has to be accountability. So I'm a taxpayer, and I know there are taxpayers watching this. So I ask a question. Do the politicians and their officials who control these programs, are they accountable just like police officers? They have they have more power than police officers. And I haven't seen the accountability. I've seen redacted emails. I've seen pictures of politicians on cell phones. And I wonder if the public has a right to see that. It's their money. And I guess I'm asking you, is there accountability amongst the people who run these programs? Because these programs are being used against us. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Two questions for me, and then Representative Albright has one, and then we're going to move on, okay?
Yes.
Sometimes people bill kids for kids who aren't there at the child care center, right?
Yes.
So have you ever heard or seen a provider's ever paying the parents kickbacks for enrolling their children, even though their children never actually attend the center? And how does one actually get kids to sign up when they're not going to be attending?
Madam Chair, I have seen videos of that. I have participated with investigators who have gone deep into that question. I can say it occurs. I can say that innocent immigrants are often exploited because of this, to their harm, because they're given a fraction of what they should be getting. They're not getting the daycare that they need. If you want details, though, I would encourage you to speak to the 12 Office of Inspector General CCAP investigators. They could give you example after example after example, including videos of that.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stillman, question for you. With regard to kind of the money flows, and you've talked about it a little bit, but in some cases, you know, the money is provided to the daycare, but I'm wondering if you can help me appreciate how, to your assertion, it gets overseas or it gets to other places, how it might end up in a political campaign fund, or help me understand what you've seen or how that has happened as you've seen forensically.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I've seen wire transfers and directions, individuals giving directions to other individuals to wire money to different accounts. We have, the Office of Inspector General has numerous search warrants from banks showing the path of that money, going to Dubai. I would encourage you, sir, look at those search warrants. They are available to you at the Office of Inspector General. They have been preserved. As far as the money going to campaigns, I can't say it's gone to a campaign. I don't know if it went to an individual as a cash payoff or it went to their campaign. I don't know. But if it influenced that politician, as a taxpayer, I think that's wrong. And I think that should be transparent. But if you want to see that information, sir, again, the evidence that you're looking for is available and is verifiable at the Office of Inspector General. And if you haven't seen that yet, I would ask for it.
Madam Chair, Mr. Stillman, when you did your forensic audit, obviously you have privy to the phone numbers and the smartphones of these individuals. But are you able and are you asserting that these phone numbers are attributable to specific individuals that you know by name?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we processed that evidence and put it into link analysis analytics. So if you want the names of those individuals, where we could find that, it is available in the Office of Inspector General records. In some cases, yes, I did know where it was going. Chair Franzen mentioned a case, the DECO case. I worked that case. I went through millions of records, 34 computers and servers and cell phones. It was the first case that we really got, and I was inundated. I worked hours. I worked nights and weekends to process that, to filter out the evidence. And I found spreadsheets in there from the owner of the daycare going to an individual who's been convicted of terroristic actions. Those records are in the DECO record, and you can go out and get those spreadsheets. You want them, they're at Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. They're on file there. They're on file at the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and the Office of Inspector General has them as well.
You said they're on record at the Ramsey County Attorney's Office?
That's correct,
and
yes.
And where else?
The Ramsey County Sheriff's Office should have a copy. The BCA, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, should have a copy as well. The BCA contracts to have officers on scene at the Department of Human Services to help them with their Office of Inspector General investigations. I would highly encourage you to speak to those officers. Go into their office. Ask to see the spreadsheets. Ask to see the diagrams of the organized crime. Ask to see the four-page, two-column-long list of suspect daycares. Ask to see their reports. Go to the Fusion Center and see those videos. The evidence is staggering. It's all there, but you haven't been shown it. It hasn't been given to you.
Thank you, Mr. Stillman, and thank you for coming today. Certainly is not an easy topic to discuss. We thank you for coming forward. Members, we're going to move on.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are fortunate enough today to be joined by a network of program of integrity professionals dedicated to the elimination of public assistance fraud. The Minnesota Fraud Investigators Association enhances communication and coordination among its members and improves the effectiveness of fraud detection and investigation through training. The committee would like to invite Crystal Herman, who is the president, and Jay Link, vice president of the Minnesota Fraud Investigator Association. Thank you for joining us today at the testifiers table. If you would please identify yourself for the record and proceed when ready.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Crystal Herman, and I am the current president of the Minnesota Fraud Investigators Association. I am also a board member of the United Council on Welfare Fraud, which is a national fraud association. I've been a collections officer for 13 years. With me is Jay Link. Jay is the vice president of our association. We also are known as Mafia. And Jay is also a member of the United Council on Welfare Fraud, the National Fraud Association. We will be providing you with an overview of the focus of our association and the FPI program, the Fraud Prevention Investigation Program. We will also discuss current barriers to the early detection and prevention of fraud in public assistance programs, specifically in the CCAP program. And finally, we'd like to provide our support of House File 3821. Mafia is a professional organization. We have approximately 100 members. Our members are investigators, administrators, prosecutors, eligibility, recovery, and collection specialists from state, federal, and county agencies. We've combined our efforts toward the prevention, detection, and elimination of fraud within government benefit programs. Many of our investigators are, many investigative members of our association are employed by counties who are part of the Fraud Prevention Investigation Program, the FPI program. Minnesota statute obligates the state to develop an FPI program. Through the FPI program, DHS, the Office of Inspector General, provides for $3.1 million in grant money to be given to the state, to the counties from the state to fund fraud prevention programs in 79 counties. The FPI program, as I said, is state-funded, but it's county-administered, and it's overseen by program administrators at DHS, OIG. Many of the remaining counties who do not receive FPI funding still have an active fraud investigation program, but in those counties, those programs are funded by the individual counties themselves. The focus of the FPI program is to identify potential fraud in the TANF, SNAP, MA, and CCAP programs at the onset of the application process in an effort to avoid large overpayments and to ensure that correct benefits are issued. The program requires rapid and accurate resolution of investigators and timely termination of benefits to ineligible recipients. The FPI program is cost neutral to the state of Minnesota, and that's a requirement under FPI legislation. Benefits of the FPI program must outweigh the administrative costs. For state fiscal year 2018, the cost-to-benefit ratio for the program was $6.87. The Child Care Provider Investigation Unit at DHS, OIG, investigates child care centers, as we've been discussing, that fraudulently bill or violate other program rules within CCAP. However, in some instances, the FPI investigators through the counties may initiate and perform their own provider investigations, especially in the outstate non-metro counties. In these instances, the FPI investigators confer and coordinate with the OIG child care investigators so they don't duplicate their investigations. Investigative techniques and resources and best practices are shared between the OIG child care investigators and the FPI county investigators. The county FPI investigators who are members of our association and have investigated child care providers have become aware of several issues in the course of these investigations. And I'd like to turn it over to Jay to share those issues with you.
Go ahead, Jay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, hello. As already mentioned, my name is Jay Link. I'm the Vice President for the Minnesota Fraud Association. I'm a fraud investigator for Sheriff's Office here in Minnesota. I have my national certification as a welfare fraud investigator. I've been licensed as a peace officer in the state of Minnesota for 12 years, and I've been doing public assistance fraud for the last four. I want to thank your committee for giving us, our association, the opportunity to talk to you today. My goal is to try to give you some insight to the barriers that our mafia members are seeing regarding child care provider fraud. Intent is an extremely important element that comes into play for criminal investigations relating to public assistance fraud. An investigation must show intent that someone wrongfully obtained public assistance in order to charge someone with a crime relating to fraud. Our members investigating daycare provider fraud have found this element to be extremely difficult under current language and statute because of how these fraudulent daycares are set up and operated. The scheme that they have identified, or we have identified, to put it short and to the point, is a shell game. These fraudulent daycares purposely layer their businesses with what we call owners, controllers, and billers. What happens is that the owner says that they are not at the daycare all the time and claim that they are unaware of the fraudulent billings. The owners then say that they give another person at the daycare the responsibility to submit the billing electronically to DHS. The people that submit the billing claim that they're unaware of any inaccurate submitted child care assistance claims because of another person or the controller operates the business and the functions of it. The biller states that they are only billing for what was written down on the attendance sheets from the teachers. This denial of knowledge really muddies the waters enough to make it tremendously difficult to prove that the owner or the controller running this tactic intentionally and wrongfully obtained public assistance dollars. Due to this, we have seen county attorneys' offices declining to prosecute as intent is not proven at the burden needed for criminal charges, really. We came up with just some solutions. Change in the theft statute, which would have the owners, the controllers, and the billers assume liability for all fraudulent activity occurring in that daycare. Another would be fixed billing access criteria set up by DHS. This could be done by having the people that submit billing to complete an application that would include full name, date of birth, social security number, a home address, email, and a copy of a government-issued photo ID. Access would expire after 1 year, but could be renewed with a submission of a new application. Another would be the application for billing must be clear, must include clear language that states billing for children not cared for constitutes fraud. And allowing another person to use a person's access ID to log in for the billing is grounds for disqualification from the DHS programs along with possible criminal prosecution. The perjury statement should be added to the child care center provider applications. This statement is on all other applications. Why is it not on this one? If it was, it would help educate the applicant regarding providing false information is a crime and also assist in the investigatory process of proving intent. Second barrier would be classified under unreasonable billing. Our investigators have found that fraud is commonly associated with retro billing, what we call retro billing in the child care program. There are several issues with retro billing that have been identified. In DHS policy, it states all provider bills must be sent to CCAP within 60 days of the last date of service on that bill. Policy states that CCAP may pay a bill submitted after the 60-day limit only if the provider shows good cause of the delay. Policy also states that CCAP cannot pay a bill submitted more than 1 year after the last date of service on the bill. Well, I can tell you that our members have found that DHS is not following its own policy regarding this by paying out bills past the submitted deadline. This has made it extremely difficult in terms of the investigative process. The investigator then has to wait months after the alleged care has been performed before they're even able to see what the daycare provider billed for. So in short, the investigator is really extremely disadvantaged from the very get-go. There are also no penalties for these providers violating the CCAP policies. This makes it difficult to conduct any case correction. Due to this, investigators often feel they are chasing their own tail, to put it short. They can't administer a sanction. They can't charge them criminally because they can't prove intent. So child care centers have found to violate policy get to remain open. It would be highly implausible that a child care center would watch a child without being paid for months with the hope that a family would be approved for child care assistance later to pay the accumulated bill. This is not normal business practice. And I often actually think of my own children and their daycare that they attend. This would never be allowed or even considered. By removing the policy that allows retro billing, it would strengthen program integrity and help shut the door for fraudulent billing. The last barrier I just want to talk about is another obstacle our members have identified is licensing practices for daycare center providers. Currently under the rules and policies set by DHS, the providers are able to become licensed very quickly with little or no proven knowledge of the policies, procedures, and rules pertaining to the operation of a child care center. A possible solution would be to require all new licensors, owners, and controllers to take a written examination to show their competency and knowledge of these statutes, rules, and policies concerning the operation of a child care center. Minnesota statute actually already allows for this. However, it has not been implemented, and this is because no money has been allocated in DHS for it. Another asset of this provision is that it would assist the investigator in establishing, back to what I was talking about before, intent. To wrap up, the barriers that are hindering our good faith efforts to curb not only daycare provider fraud, but fraud within other public assistance programs, we need to re-examine current policy and add provisions in our statutory language, along with other possible solutions that I mentioned before. This will help keep program integrity by keeping public confidence high while being good stewards of public tax dollars that are funding these programs. I'm going to hand it back over to Crystal regarding concerns that our members have expressed regarding other public assistance programs. Thank you.
Our investigative members also do predominantly investigate recipient fraud, and they have brought a number of issues to our attention regarding recipient fraud and the issues they're seeing in preventing and early detection of fraud in those programs. So I would just like to hit on a few of those before we wrap up. One of the barriers we run into is that program policies and rules, they're often not consistent with Minnesota statute and federal regulation. An example of that is that a recipient who uses their benefits to purchase alcohol and tobacco products has committed an intentional program violation under federal regulation. But within the language in Minnesota statute, a client is prohibited from using their EBT debit card to purchase these items. There's nothing that prohibits the client from going to an ATM machine, withdrawing cash, walking back over to the counter, and purchasing prohibited items. Under federal regulation, the client would have committed an intentional program violation. But Minnesota statute isn't consistent with the federal regulation because of the EBT debit card language that's within Minnesota statute. So we would like to see this and other inconsistencies in Minnesota statute addressed so that the law can be applied in accordance with federal rules and regulations. Also, there's significant programming issues within the METS and MNSURE programming that causes program integrity to be nearly non-existent in medical assistance. For example, the fraud release language is missing from the METS or MNSURE application, and that makes it very difficult for our investigators to obtain information from banks and employers. It's also impossible for us to print the online application that's completed by an MA applicant on the MNSURE system. Investigators in other states have shared that they don't have difficulty in printing these applications in their states. Next, there's minimal safeguards to verify the information a client is inputting into the MNSURE program is in fact accurate. A client could be found ineligible for medical assistance because of, for example, unreported income. They could be shut down and closed on the system today. But there's nothing that prevents them from reapplying tomorrow with a new set of circumstances. Also, when applying for medical assistance, an applicant can indicate that they intend to make Minnesota their home and be found eligible for medical assistance as long as the other program requirements are met. The residency language is very vague, and it's open to broad interpretation. So we would like to see these and other METS programming issues repaired, and we would also like to see legislation that more clearly defines residency for the MA program. Also, the continual evolution of relaxed reporting requirements limits an investigator's ability to detect fraud early on. Simplified reporting, for example, in the SNAP program. This only requires most recipients to report changes to us every 6 months. This has made it more difficult for investigators to detect fraud as quickly as possible, and it increases the amount of benefits that are issued incorrectly. We have concerns with Minnesota statute that excludes the earned and unearned income of a new spouse from counting towards the income of an assistance unit for 12 months. A household's income could have increased significantly because of a marriage, but the household would see no reduction in their benefits for 12 months. We would like to see monthly reporting reinstated for the SNAP program and maintained for the MFIT program. We would also be in support of legislation that includes a new spouse's income when determining eligibility. Another concern we have, probably one of our biggest concerns, is with self-attestation. For some programs, self-attestation is all that's required from individuals to verify things like bank accounts and income and expenses. The agency makes a determination simply based on a state client's statement. The agency isn't required to verify any of the information the client provides for some programs. Many of the overpayments of benefits that I see as a collections officer could have been avoided if the agency would have verified the information from the very beginning. We recently became aware of a DHS policy interpretation that directed the county agency not to include a lifetime $2,200 monthly annuity payment that a client was receiving when determining MA eligibility, as long as the client could attest that the income was non-taxable. We'd like to see self-attestation eliminated by requiring participants to verify and provide proof of their bank accounts, income, and expenses for all programs. Also, since 2013, there's no longer asset tests for some programs and individuals. Yet we've kept the asset limits in place for some of our most vulnerable, the elderly and the disabled. I think we're all familiar with the millionaire who received SNAP benefits for a number of months. We're seeing an increasing number of individuals with significant assets who are now eligible for SNAP and medical assistance. Common sense rules have to be applied to these programs to ensure that assistance is provided to those who rely on it for their basic and most immediate needs. We'd like to see the asset test reinstated for the programs it was removed from in 2013. Finally, our investigator members have expressed increased frustration with self-employed individuals. These recipients are only reporting to the agency a minimum income that they're receiving from their self-employment business. But they're using their business's other income to pay their personal expenses, their mortgage, their car payments, revolving lines of credit, and their current on all of those payments. Program rules only allow the agency to count the income that the client is claiming they're actually receiving from the business, but not that business income that they're using to pay all of their, in my opinion, extravagant personal expenses and lifestyles. We have clients that live in $350,000 homes and drive $50,000 vehicles, but they're only claiming $1,000 a month in income to the agency. House File 3821, which was brought forward in the 2018 legislative session, seeks to modify these statutes that cover MFIP, SNAP, MA, and CCAP. By counting as income or assets, money from a business, loan, or commingled account that's being used to pay personal expenses. Under current rules, a non-self-employed individual would not be eligible for the same benefits as a self-employed individual. Mafia supports House File 3821 because it prevents individuals from misrepresenting their circumstances in an effort to receive benefits they would not otherwise be entitled to. In closing, fraud prevention investigations provide a safety net for the taxpayers, as well as for the needy and the impoverished, because we hold accountable the people who are being untruthful in order to receive benefits they're not entitled to. We do this so the citizens of Minnesota who are truly in need will continue to have access to the publicly funded benefits they rely on to meet their most basic needs. Thank you again for this opportunity, and we would entertain any questions you may have.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Herman and Mr. Link. Do you feel the policies that have been approved by DHS for the FPI program are effective, or are they obstructive?
Madam Chair, Committee, I would say that the policies in place from DHS for the FPI program and for the public assistance programs, I'll just be blunt, I do feel, and I believe our members feel, that fraud is kind of an afterthought. In terms of that, we are not consulted, or I guess we learn of policy provisions and changes through our financial workers, and that's where we learn from them, or that's where we hear from them. And I think the policies are do make our some of the policies have made our investigations difficult to pursue and whatnot. Get myself in check here. A little nervous. That's what I would say. So, yeah, they have not helped us in any way. We would like to build a bridge a little bit with our relationship with DHS in that matter, with the policy people, is what I should say.
Would you say that your relationship with DHS is amicable, or is there sometimes some headbutting and frustration that takes place? To me, it sounds like there's frustration, but...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have a very good relationship with the FPI administrators of the FPI program at the OIG DHS. And also with the child care assistance provider investigators in the OIG as well. I will say that our members, especially since I've been part of Mafia for the past 4 years since I've been a fraud investigator, there's been a lot of frustration with DHS, and we feel that there's a disconnect, I guess is the best way to say it. Like I said, I've never been, that I know of, our association has never been consulted with or approached to discuss possible when policy changes are being discussed for program rules, to view or hear our input and how it would potentially affect fraud, if that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. Members, does anybody else have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Mr. Link, you used the word kind of conflicted or there with regard to the response that you received from DHS. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Madam Chair. I guess, can you clarify what part of my statement on the whether our relationship with DHS, is that what you're talking about, or...
You mentioned in an earlier comment that fraud was, in your words, an afterthought. Why would that be if they are supposed to be stewards of the taxpayer's dollar?
Madam Chair, members, I don't know why that would be. You would think that it should be a concern for DHS in general and for the taxpayers. I don't know why that is, but... I can speak in terms of the investigators across the state that are members in our association that we do feel that we are an afterthought, especially with these policies that have been implemented at DHS. Yes, that is correct. I would stand by that, if that answers your question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Link, have you been interviewed or has MAFIA been interviewed or sat down and made these presentations available to the OLA?
Madam Chair, committee, no, we have not.
Is there some reason why that wouldn't have been taking place?
Mr. Link?
Madam Chair, committee, I could not speak to that or answer your question on that. No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Mr. Link, Ms. Hennen, being an afterthought certainly isn't a good feeling for someone that obviously wants to be a good steward of the taxpayer dollar. To what level have your frustrations risen within DHS?
Mr. Link?
Madam Chair, committee, like I explained earlier, we definitely feel there's a disconnect with our members of our association feel there's a disconnect with DHS. So obviously there's a large level of frustration regarding that. We are seeing things, we're seeing schemes, and we're not being consulted with. And our opinion is not being taken into play or into consideration to potentially curb some of these schemes or just general trends that we're seeing in the fraud world. There's a lot of them. Public assistance is extremely convoluted, and I found that out when I first started doing fraud investigations for public assistance. My head was absolutely spinning, and I now, just now after 4 years, kind of feel somewhat able to understand a lot of this, and there's a lot more to learn. It's very convoluted, and yes, does that answer your question, sir?
Mr. Link, Madam Chair, you mentioned schemes that you brought to the attention of DHS. What specific schemes have you brought to their attention?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, committee, I guess if I misspoke, we have, as far as I understand, have not approached DHS and talked about specific schemes. I guess what I'm trying to explain is that our members of our association who are investigators throughout the state and other counties have seen tactics and schemes to obtain public assistance dollars.
Mr. Link, Madam Chair, but you have alerted DHS to your awareness of these inappropriate activities taking place.
I think it means the association.
The association has brought those to the attention of DHS.
Madam Chair, committee, we have testified in the Senate in that way to advise of the schemes and so forth that we have seen. I guess I can't answer your question regarding specifically contacting DHS other than we work closely with the DHS OIG and receive training through them.
One final question, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Linker, Ms. Hennen, If you were to uncover, per se, a scheme or an activity that was of a criminal intent, who would that need to be reported to by you, by your association? You're obligated to report those findings, but who do you report those findings to?
Mr. Link?
Madam Chair, committee, thank you. For the question, if we did see fraudulent activity in a certain area of public assistance, we obviously would refer that to that specific jurisdiction of that matter. Like for example, if there was something down in the city of Faribault, and it's a recipient fraud type allegation or tip, it would be referred to them for follow-up by their fraud investigator down there. If it was child care assistance provider fraud, it would be referred to the DHS OIG's 12 investigators that they have for
thank
follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Link.
Well, thank you.
I have one quick question. Are there, back to the child care assistance fraud, Are there any cases right now that you're working on?
Madam Chair, committee, Mafia does not conduct our own investigations. Our organization has investigators within it, or the members are investigators from other jurisdictions across the state. That's how we're composed. So we do not specifically conduct investigations. We are just a private association that we receive training and consult with each other for other resources. Myself personally, I have done a little bit of child care assistance provider fraud, but that's not my main. I primarily do recipient fraud where I'm located, if that answers your question.
Sure. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you for coming forward today. We appreciate the insight to all public programs. Thank you for the work that you do.
Yep. Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
I think I'd like to ask a question of Mr. Noble.
Okay. And then we need to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nobles, in light of the presentation provided by Mafi, well, how would you respond to some of the assertions and or comments made by them or the questions that were presented to them?
Mr. Nobles?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Albright, I would say that a lot of what we heard, what you heard, are things that we have heard from individual investigators, and I just want to correct the record. We have, in fact, talked to many of their members ongoing over the years, but also specifically on this investigation, we have spoken individually to their members. As I think Mr. Link just said, I mean, this is a professional association. They themselves have no responsibility to report as an association. They're individual members who are county fraud investigators. That's where the responsibility, that's where the activity occurs. And we have spoken to those individuals about fraud of various kinds and specifically their insights into CCAP fraud. So in my office, we have a large number of certified fraud examiners. This is the work we do, and so we have a connection with the folks who are doing it at the local level as well as the state level. So, but I would say, just in answer to your specific question, you're hearing what we're hearing from people who do this work.
All right.
Thank you, Manager.
Thank you, Mr. Albert. Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Okay, next up, we'd like to hear from the Department of Human Services, Office of Inspector General, which manages financial fraud and abuse investigations. Here to brief us on the OIG process, trends in fraud, and obstacles preventing the state from prevention or earlier detection of fraud is Inspector General Carolyn Hamm. And she's phoned a friend as well. So thank you both for coming to the testifying table. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed when ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carolyn Hamm. I am the Inspector General for the Department of Human Services, and I've served in that role since the end of March 2017. I want to thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to present to you. I've presented to the Senate committee a number of times on our efforts in the child care area, but I haven't had that opportunity, and so I appreciate the opportunity. I'm going to start with just a very brief overview of what we've been doing and then happy to sort of dig into some of the things that are going on here. So if you may or may not know, the OIG was created in 2011. And currently we have four different divisions. We have our licensing division, our background studies division, our financial fraud and investigations division, and our legal department. Okay, So the Financial Fraud and Abuse Investigations Division, we have several missions, one of which is to investigate Medicaid fraud, and that is done by our CSRS unit. We also have our Child Care Assistance Provider Fraud Unit, and we will I'll get into that in great much greater detail. And then as the Mafia, that sounds so strange, anyway, just testified, we administer the FPI grant, which funds the county investigators who look for the eligibility fraud. So just a brief history on the Child Care Assistance Program. As the legislative auditor, Jim Noble, indicated, this is not, unfortunately, is not a new problem. We in the OIG, well, I don't even know if it was the OIG at the time, but anyway, in 2011, 2012, we started to see some strange behaviors in child care centers that didn't make sense to us, and this was on our licensors. Our licensors were going out, and they were seeing things that didn't make sense in a child care, like all the toys are in their boxes and not opened. And so they started looking around and talking to other states. We talked to Wisconsin and in particular because they were experiencing this, and we realized that we've got fraud here. So then we looked around and we said, well, who has jurisdiction for that? And it really, there wasn't a specific entity that was looking at that. The county attorneys could certainly prosecute it. The U.S. attorney could prosecute it, but no one had primary responsibility. So it was actually DHS that went to the legislature in 2013 and asked for the authority to investigate the child care fraud and also get the staff. So in 2014 is when we were fully staffed, and at that time it was only four investigators. So currently, thanks to the legislative appropriation from 2017, we now have nine investigators. However, that is looking at approximately 1,200 child care centers, providers, and we are mainly looking at investigations based on tips. And we do have a backlog. We've gotten through some of the backlog due to our additional staff, but we do still have some backlog. And I just want to make sure that people are clear that Scott Stillman was never part of the OIG. He was part of DHS. He worked in the Digital Forensics Unit, which is a very important unit that does support the OIG. But he did not work within the OIG. I just want to make that clear. So the other thing I want to make clear is that, as some folks indicated, we do work very closely with the BCA. We actually have two agents who are embedded, if you will, that are actually at our offices, and we work very closely with them. And the division of labor, if you will, is that our investigators do the initial workup. When they get to a point where they think we may have evidence of a crime being committed, we then consult with our BCA agents who are right there with us. They then make the determination if they think we have enough to go on a criminal case, and if so, they then take over that case. It is their responsibility. We assist in every way we can, but from that point on, it is the BCA that's going to be working on it, and any search warrants that would be executed would be through the BCA. So at this point, we do get tips from all over, including the counties, which is one of our main sources. We get tips from neighbors. We get tips from competitors. We also law enforcement, banks. We get many different sources, and as well as state agencies, including our own licensing division. In fact, oftentimes our licensing division are the ones that are going to be noticing that something doesn't seem quite right about this center. We've talked a little bit about what fraud looks like in this program, and so I don't think I need to go into a lot of detail, but in fact, we do know that kickbacks are paid so that the parents get money for each child that they agree to be able to be billed for. The child may or may not go to the center, may go there for a brief amount of time and then leave. And the basic scheme is that they're billing for children who aren't there. That's as basic as it gets. But there are more complicated things such as in order to qualify for child care assistance, you have to show that you have a job. So the provider might create false pay stubs to show that the person has a job when, in fact, they don't have a job. So this just sort of gives you the general overview. So in terms of what are the possible outcomes of our investigations, there could be no action. And when I get to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about that. We may be that we can't prove any intent, but we can prove that there's an overpayment, and so we will recover that overpayment. We may feel like we have enough evidence to show that there was fraud, possibly not enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but we may have enough proof that we will seek to disqualify that provider from the child care assistance program. We also will, if the evidence warrants it, refer it to law enforcement. As I said, that will typically go to the BCA, and then they will make the referral over to either the county attorney or the U.S. attorney, depending on who has interest in it. We have worked with both county attorneys and U.S. attorneys. And we also might refer it to other state agencies or the feds. In fact, I should have said to step back, every time we open a child care assistance fraud case, we call the Department of Human Services, DHHS OIG, so the federal OIG, and we tell them we're doing that, and they open a case too. So we work very closely with the federal authorities on all of our investigations so that we can be working in lockstep. And also, of course, because we don't have jurisdiction to follow money transfers, to know if money, where money might be ending up. And so that is one of the reasons why we work so closely with the federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, the IRS, and DHS OIG, because these are complicated investigations that really require multiple layers of investigation. So just wanted to give a cumulative, what have we done since our founding in basically 2014? So we've done 171 civil investigations. And what that means is those are ones, so as you may have, I think we heard earlier, people are required to have attendance records. When we go out and we ask, all right, we want to see your attendance records, they have to have them right there on the scene. And so we will do an investigation of, we will compare the attendance records to the billing to make sure that it matches. And so that's what these 171 civil investigations consist of. And in the vast majority of those, there are no overpayments. The records match the billing. And so I want to keep that in mind because this is it's a hard message to, but childcare fraud is a big problem, and it's in the millions of dollars. However, we don't have any evidence that it's 50% or anything like that. And so one of the reasons I say that is we look at this, where we do these civil investigations, and we don't find widespread problems. Sorry. Of those 171, we had 10 cases where there was an overpayment, and we were able to collect the $382,000. Here's the other important fact. So during the course of our investigations, we have stopped payments to 16 centers. 16 centers out of 1,700. So those cases were bad. We know they were fraud, but it's only 16 centers. And that is the problem with trying to extrapolate from 16 centers out of 1,700 to go to where we are with the percentage of fraud or the amount. Now, again, to not minimize it, if you look at those 16 centers, over the course of their existence, which they could have been open anywhere from, 1 to 5 years, they billed $66 million. So, again, it is substantial, no doubt about it. But I want us to deal with facts and where the facts take us, not supposition. 16 cases doesn't give us the ability to extrapolate across a wide range of 1,700 centers. Finally, in terms of convictions, we've had 5 felony convictions, and out of that, restitution was ordered in the amount of $1.6 million, and as is often the case, we we have not been able to collect that. We've collected $175,000. So that concludes my PowerPoint. I just want to say that I think we are all in agreement that child care assistance fraud is a very serious problem. It not only hurts our taxpayers, but it hurts our children, the children who aren't getting the quality care that we want to have. And so we are absolutely committed to trying to reduce, if not eliminate, child care fraud. And if you will look at, I think you have the spreadsheet or the sheet there, we have come back to this legislature repeatedly trying to revise this program, trying to cut down on some of the abuses that we see, and we fully intend to continue to do that because this is a very serious issue. And so as an example, today DHS is issuing a request for information. And what we're going to be asking for is we want to know what are the technological solutions for an electronic check-in system, because we believe that may be a way to significantly cut down on some of this fraud. There are different types and different costs, and so we don't want to pick one or decide or propose a specific one. We want to find out what's out there. We've been talking with other states. For example, Ohio has just put in a new electronic check-in system that actually takes a photo of the person when they check in, and they've seen some good results. So we are certainly not resting at this point in terms of what we need to do to better the program, but it is certainly not being ignored, and it is absolutely a top priority.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hamm. On May 15th, Chair Dean, he's in the spectator crowd right now, he filed a five-part data practices request with DHS to investigate more closely the information obtained by Fox 9 and other vital data related to the CCAP scandal. DHS have subsequently asked for multiple clarifications on the simple and straightforward five-part request. At the requested clarifications were made, and after waiting an additional 5 weeks without receiving any data, on August 23rd, Chair Dean sent an email to DHS asking the department to expedite the process of delivering on the data practices request. Then on October 25th, DHS sent information to Chair Dean, which they felt fulfilled the first component of the five-part request, that is, all communications with members of news organizations related to CCAP fraud. Upon review, the data provided was so heavily redacted as to render the information useless. No response has been received from DHS in regard to the other four elements of Chair Dean's request. What are we to make of the non-responsiveness and delay? How difficult is it to identify communications referring to Al-Shabaab, terrorists, or terrorism? And is the volume of such communications so overwhelming that it requires more time? Now, to me, it looks like the department is stonewalling and trying to brush this FOIA underneath the rug because Chair Dean has retired. This is his last month serving as state rep. And it looks like the department is slow walking this FOIA as not to have to answer to Representative Matt Dean.
Madam Chair, I am not involved other than I provided documents that were responsive. I am not involved with that. I know we are working on it. I know we intend to give all the documents that have been requested, regardless of Representative Dean's status, but I don't have any details on the specifics of it.
All right, Ms. Hamm, who would know the answers to this? Because he's been asking since May 15th. This is December 17th. So many months. It's 7 months.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
State your name for the record.
Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. We are working on the data request, and it is in our legal department. I don't have a specific name that I can give you today, but I can certainly go back to the office and speak with our legal department to see where we're at on that.
Okay. So, like I said, it has been 7 months. So can we expect it by the end of the week then? I mean, 7 months is a long time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know that I can speak to a specific time, but I will check in with our legal department and see where we are at on it. I know people are working on it. It was a significant amount of, a number of requests, so we are working on it.
Okay. I have some more questions. Ms. Hamm, does the OIG believe the CCAP program has elevated degrees of fraud relative to other taxpayer-funded programs?
Madam Chair, that I guess I don't know the answer to that. Again, given the amount of cases that we've done, that's where I have trouble with. The amount of cases that we've done, I can't extrapolate across. Is it a problem? Absolutely. Is it a serious problem? Yes. Is it higher than in, you know, Medicaid? I don't know.
Has the OIG conducted any internal reviews of fraud within the CCAP program?
Madam Chair, could you clarify a little bit? Do you mean have we looked at our unit, or what are you asking? I'm sorry.
Just any internal reviews.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. As a result of all, you know, the publicity, the OLA audit, we have certainly taken a close look at our unit, and we are recognizing some improvements that we can make in that unit, and are doing so. And so I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at, but I can tell you we certainly have looked at what are we doing, how are we doing it, and what is the evidence that we actually have.
Okay. I'm just looking for a simple yes or no question.
Sorry.
Have you done any internal reviews regarding to the Fox 9 report?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. What were the findings of that internal review?
That, Madam Chair, what that review has looked like is looking at how we are doing the work we're doing, and whether our investigations can be improved. With regard to some of the allegations with having to do with the money going overseas and those aspects, I can tell you that we know that money has gone overseas. That is in the public record in terms of some of the criminal cases that have been brought. Those are some of the allegations. But again, that would be certainly beyond our jurisdiction, OIG. We are not a law enforcement agency. And it would even be beyond the jurisdiction of the BCA, because again, now we're talking about international and federal matters. And that is why we work so closely with the federal agencies in order in the event that any such evidence were found.
Okay. Did the internal review suggest that the scope of fraud within the CCAP program is larger than DHS has previously acknowledged?
We have individuals who are of the opinion that is the case. However, our review has not been able to substantiate that.
Have steps been taken to rectify the issues identified in this internal review and improve how we combat the CCAP fraud?
Madam Chair, yes, we are taking several steps to increase the accountability, transparency of the way we do our cases, as well as how we approach our cases.
Can you please provide us a copy of the internal review?
Madam Chair, there was not a formal written internal review. I think what you're talking about is something else.
Has any employee actually provided you with an internal review?
Madam Chair, we have received information from an individual, and I would have to consult as to whether or not that's public.
Who is the PFM group?
The PFM Group is Public Finance Management, and it is an outside entity that has been hired by the commissioner in order to take a look at our unit in the wake of the allegations that suggested that fraud was at 50% and that DHS had somehow not acted on it. And so we did engage an outside entity to get an objective third-party examination of our program.
Mm-hmm. Is PFM currently conducting an evaluation of the internal review?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Is it standard practice to contract with outside entities to evaluate OIG reviews?
Madam Chair, I can't speak to standard practice since my time is relatively short there, but I think this is fairly unusual, but it actually, and it has to do with the fact that the allegations that were present were so disturbing that we felt we needed to get a quick and objective third-party review of the allegations so that we could proceed.
And Ms. Hamm, why did the OIG initiate an evaluation of the internal review?
Madam Chair, it was the commissioner that initiated it, and it was because she, again, as I said, wanted to have, because some of the allegations were quite serious, she wanted to have a third party to be able to evaluate that, and quickly. And again, I will say that because, of course, we have the OLA that is auditing us, and we welcome that audit, but we knew that their timeline was going to be longer necessarily and wouldn't necessarily give us the concrete recommendations. We're looking for best practices in order to, in terms of what we should be doing, and we did not feel the OLA would necessarily be giving us the specifics that we need.
And Ms. Hamm, were there reasons to doubt the validity of the concerns raised by the OIG staff that prompted the contract with PFM? Now, taxpayers are paying a salary to the investigators within the OIG. The department hires reputable people to work with them. Why would the department not trust them and hire an outside group?
Madam Chair, again, it has, as I cited previously, we've investigated 16 centers. That is simply not enough centers to make credible claims and extrapolate across a program that has 1,700 participants.
So, Ms. Hamm, are you saying that the employees that we have working for the state of Minnesota investigating cases of fraud and abuse are not to be trusted, and we, as the taxpayers, should be contracting each and every time with an outside group?
Madam Chair, I'm not saying that.
What is the cost of this evaluation?
Madam Chair, there is a maximum amount of the contract, and I believe it's approximately $90,000. I don't know how much they've billed so far.
Where is the RFP for this contract?
Madam Chair, we can get it for you. I don't have it, but we can get it for you.
Okay, I would like a document of the RFP along with the contract to each and every member of the body, including those that are not here today as well. And I'd like that by Friday.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hamm, are you responsible to report the contracting out of services for an internal audit of your own organization to the legislature or to this committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I'm not aware of such an obligation. And I didn't hire anyone.
In the testimony based upon the MAFI, they talked about intent and how difficult that is to approve. But they also said that your organization may not be as responsive to the concerns that they raised to you. How would you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, it's always a very difficult balance between having program integrity and having accessibility for people who need it. It's a constant tension that we have within DHS. And I will tell you that from my perspective, one of the significant roles of the OIG is to bring that program integrity lens to everything we do. So what I can say is that we absolutely would support looking that the OIG does not take fraud lightly, and we are very much at the table in terms of any concerns that we have. As I say, you always have to be weighing that against can you operationalize it, for example. And so it's I appreciate the county and probably would support what they're saying, but we have to look at overall, is it even administrated? Can you even administer the changes that you're suggesting?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Ms. Hamm, in Mr. Stillman's testimony, he made some assertions with regard to inaction on the part of the OIG or the DHS. And how would you respond to those?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I have not gotten any specifics on cases that allegedly were stopped by a politician, and I would ask Mr. Stillwell after the hearing to give me the names of those because I don't even know they might still be under investigation. But I'm happy to look into that because that would be very, very serious. But no one has ever brought specific cases to me that told me of instances where we stood down because some politician told us to. I'm not aware of any of those.
Ms. Hamm, who is your immediate supervisor?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I report directly to the commissioner.
And the commissioner only reports to whom? It's a rhetorical question.
Representative Albright, typically rhetorical means I don't answer, sorry. The governor.
And with regard to policy, there have been some assertions made about retro compensation paid. Obviously, that's been going on for some time. I'm just curious as to why, when you talk about the fraud that you've discovered, that you didn't mention those issues as well as being prominent to the concerns that you raise about CCAP and the work that you're doing there.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I gave you a very high-level overview of the fraud. I agree that that is an issue. It is one that we've talked about. I believe that we have attempted to change it in the past. It is something we're looking at to change in the future. But I will point out that the reason those things happen is because it's the county that approves the payment. DHS doesn't approve any retroactive payments. I was thinking of the issue of them submitting the claims well after the fact, and that is maintained by the county. I'm sorry. But it's certainly an issue we're looking at, both the retroactivity and the how long you have to submit a payment.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hamm, there's been a comment made about how easy it is to be a licensed daycare provider in this state. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I would disagree with that characterization. It is, as the mafia indicated, they have to show competence. The owners have to show competence. And I will say it's been an evolving area for us. We've realized that we have to probe more deeply. Initially, sometimes we'd have consultants who would be meeting with the licensors and the owners, and the consultants would know the answers, but not the owners. And so we realized, all right, we've got to cut out those consultants. We've got to talk to the owners. We've got to make sure that they're the ones who know, how to run a child care center. And so I will say that I think we've gotten better at that. I believe we have denied licenses for lack of competence. So we are looking at that. And one of the proposals that we are talking about, obviously it's up to the governor-elect, is that perhaps we need to have in the first year, which is usually our most difficult year with centers, is that we would have additional visits out there with our licensors, because then we could quickly see if somebody is seeming to be operating properly, do they know what they're doing, and so that is something that we're looking at, is increasing the staffing so that in the first year we could get out there more often, and in the cases where we get indications that perhaps this is fraudulent, of course they would then refer it to our CCAP provider fraud unit.
Ms. Hamm, you say in this PowerPoint that you have investigated 10, I forget the number, you can correct me on it, number of centers that were fraudulent of payment structures. Can you tell me how often you visited those in the first year?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I could not. I can tell you that typically for licensing, we want to get out there within the first year. But I can't tell you for those particular ones. As you may be aware, we recently significantly increased the size of our staff because we were on a two-year schedule of visiting child care centers, and with the federal requirements, we had to go to getting out there every year, and so we have had a significant increase. I suppose what I could do is we could go back and look and see when licensing visits occurred for those centers, but I don't have that offhand.
So, Ms. Hamm, once an entity is licensed, to your point, do they basically get a free pass for the first year?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, they probably are not going to get a visit. However, if there are any complaints, whether it's a maltreatment complaint or just a licensing complaint, we will go out and look at and investigate that.
And Ms. Hamm, if they were to be found in a violation of their licensure and it was revoked, what measures might be taken or are taken to prevent them from restart a new daycare entity with the same organizational structure or same ownership?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we would the fact that they were revoked would mean that owner would not be able to just come back in and open up another center.
And Ms. Hamm, is that correlated to family relations? So if the license is held by the one spouse, the other one could then establish the daycare center, but the other one could still work there?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yes, I know we had a situation where that exact scenario happened.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Ms. Hamm, I have a series of questions for you. The first one is, according to the project plan, high-level findings were to be submitted to DHS this past Friday from PFM. Can you discuss the high-level findings with us today?
Madam Chair, that may have been the project plan, but as far as I know, we're not there yet. We're waiting for the final findings.
Okay, because I read the report, and it was very specific that you needed the findings on the 25th. You had a very tight plan. It was very well noted in this. And so you're saying that you do not have that.
Madam Chair, so it was November 25th? Is that what you're saying?
December 14th.
Oh, December 14th. Yep. Okay,
December
sorry.
14th. Yep. So Friday.
So we do not have a final report yet.
Do you have a report at all?
Yes, we have a draft.
Okay, so you have a draft. Has anything PFM discovered giving you reasons to doubt the validity of the internal review?
Madam Chair, yes.
Uh-huh. Just want to go back for a moment to the decision to hire PFM. I want to get a little better understanding of why the decision was made to bring in an outside firm to evaluate an internal review conducted by the OIG. I guess all of us here, my colleagues, because the other colleagues are not here, are having a little bit of trouble understanding what specifically caused you to decide that an outside firm was needed.
Madam Chair, one of the allegations is that DHS leadership has not been listening. And so that is a very serious allegation, and we felt we needed a third party to come in and evaluate that, because any kind of evaluation that we did would be automatically suspect. So that's why we hired a third party.
Okay, so your own employee said, we don't feel that we are being listened to, so you brought in a third party to find out if they were truly being listened to.
Madam Chair, we brought in a third party to evaluate the totality of the claims.
Have OIG staff brought to you or the DHS commissioner reports about the scope of fraud and the department's efforts to fight it?
Madam Chair, I have received allegations of the scope of fraud. I wouldn't call it a report, but I have received that from my staff, yes.
Okay. What did it tell you?
Again, Madam Chair, it follows Mr. Stillman's allegations that the fraud level is at 50%. And as I say, that's why we brought in the third party to evaluate whether that could possibly be true. And so that's what we did.
Within the department, is there a level of fraud that triggers an outside group such as PFM stepping in? Is it the 50% is the magic mark? If Mr. Stillman would have said 10%, would you have hired an outside firm? If he would have said it was 20%, what is that magic number that says, well, we need an internal review?
Madam Chair, I don't think it's a number. The allegation is one that is contrary to the evidence and the data that we have, and so that was one reason. And as I said, the allegation was that leadership is somehow standing in the way. And so those were serious allegations that we felt we needed to have an outside entity weigh in on.
All right. If a center is willing to provide kickbacks, why would they not falsify records?
Madam Chair, I agree. They would.
Okay, so then wouldn't it be harder to detect fraud if everything looks like it's on the up and up?
Madam Chair, yes, it is harder. However, are you talking about the civil investigations that we've done?
I'm just speaking in general.
Okay. Well, what I can say is that with fraudulent centers, typically what we would encounter is they aren't keeping the attendance records as they go along because they're making it up, right? So they'll just wait until the end of the week and then make up a bunch of stuff. When we go in, they have to have the records right there. And so when we do a comparison of the records versus the billing and it matches, that's at least an initial indication that they are probably operating properly. Because most often with the fraudulent centers, if we go in and we collect the records and we check the billing, they aren't going to match because it's not based on anything that's real.
All right. We have a question from Representative Quam, who is online. Representative Quam.
Greetings, Madam Chair. I did have a question for Ms. Ham.
Okay. What is that question, Representative Quam?
Okay. Listening to the testimony, you're indicating that there was an internal look, that you had discovered things, and you're going to have improvements. You're starting to make those improvements. Is there a list of the improvements and what you have discovered?
Ms. Ham?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I don't have a list at the moment. We were waiting for the OLA report because we believe that there'll be other suggestions for us, but we could certainly provide for you the changes we've already put into place.
Thank you. Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm a little bit surprised that the topic of this meeting that they and they reference that they're doing activities that they wouldn't have come with that list, but I'm a little bit disconcerted that when asked if there was a report, a written report, testimony has indicated that there isn't one. So apparently all this work is being done conversationally. Is it appropriate for data preservation requirement of an agency to not document internal reports? And that would be a non-rhetorical, actual question Ms. Hamm.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I think the difference is just having to do with the nomenclature. There's been reference to an internal report. I wouldn't characterize what we have as an internal report. That's the only difference. We have it, we're maintaining it, and we're responding to it.
Madam Chair, the issue I have is that if a county board, city council did activities and had no documentation, written documentation they can present for the activities, they would not really be complying with some of the data preservation statutes. And I'm trying to understand an entity such as the Inspector General Office, who's in charge of investigating, monitoring, and making sure that things are done correctly and appropriately, can't produce written documentation that actions are being taken on to resolve some, I guess, very public issues. Getting back to some of the testimony, I heard, I believe, 10 out of 171 where they were verifying billing, and that only 16 out of 1,700, so about 1%, were investigated blocked. But you're only sampling, at least in that period, at 171. You have 10 of those fail, which is much greater than the 1%. So what period of time were the 171 in, and why is the issue that's presented many times greater than what you're saying, that the problem is only 16 out of 1,700? Ms. Hamm.
Ms. Hamm. Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm not sure I'm following the last part of your question. In terms of how the 171 investigations is since we began doing the civil investigations, and I believe that starts in 2016, and I'm not quite following the second question. And I should just make clear that the 171 is a separate number than the 16. So the 171 were civil cases that we looked at. The 16 are ones where we at least initially thought we had criminal cases. Some of them ended up being criminal cases. Some didn't. But we did ultimately recommend that their payments be suspended because of fraud. So maybe you could, if you could rephrase the latter part of your question.
Okay, Madam Chair, sorry about that. I don't have a transcript in front of me, but I believe it was somewhere in the figure of 10 out of the 171 that there were issues when comparing the billing. That is not quite 10%, but it's a whole lot more than 1%. And so I'm trying to understand, usually when you do a sampling, it is of the same relative magnitude if you're doing an appropriate, sampling of a, and I'm just confused as to why there's a discussion of, well, it's such a small problem when your sampling shows that it's a larger degree problem. And I guess we'll have to wait for the Mr. Noble and his entity to do a thorough, complete, and accurate assessment to actually know what the truth is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, may I briefly respond?
Yes. Thanks, Ms. Hamm.
Representative Quam, I just want to be clear. This wasn't sampling. This is just what we have done. So that's part of the issue. We haven't done any kind of statistically valid random sample. These are the cases that we have investigated. And so, yes, 10 out of the 171 had overpayment problems, and then we've done 16 cases so far. So I don't want anyone to think that this is somehow a sample. And that's part of the difficulty in trying to, when people want to know, well, what is the percentage of fraud? We don't know, and I didn't say it's not a small. I didn't say it's a small problem. What I said is the number of cases we have brought are too small for us to make broad sweeping judgments about the scope of fraud. It is a serious problem, and we are absolutely addressing it.
Madam Chair, that does bring up, if you only found 10 were the discrepancies, and there were 16 that investigated and blocked. For fraud, what other activities is producing the six additionals in the 10?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the very last part of that question.
You said you had 10 of 171 where you were checking it out and that came out. Well, and that wasn't sampling, that was just normal processing. But 16 is a larger number than 10, and you're using 16 out of 1,700. Therefore, what other activities are finding these cases of fraud that you're pursuing? Because you've only talking about where you had the 171 and you found 10. What other processes, and then we can maybe find out what the data is on that to where you get the 16.
Thank you, Representative Quam. So just to be clear, we have two separate processes that we do. One is a routine going out. Whenever we go out to the centers, we get records and we determine whether or not they match the billing. That's the 171, and that's the 10 that we found overpayments. The other, the 16, is the ones where we have a tip, we have some reason to believe that fraud is occurring, we do the investigation, and in those cases we ultimately did close them down. We have other investigations underway, I can't speak to those because they are confidential, but that would be the sum total of the activities that we are doing is our civil cases, and then our criminal if they don't end up criminal because nobody takes them because it's too high a burden, then we will do a try to disqualify them from the program.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Hamm?
Yes.
Have there been complaints of hostility towards any whistleblowers, people that are protecting our taxpayer dollars that have come forward, exposed some holes or loopholes and are concerned? Are there concerns?
Madam Chair, I am not aware of any reports like that.
All right. So you've not heard of anybody being treated hostile, or there may be a hostile work environment for those that have come forward?
Madam Chair, I have not.
All right. Do you feel that there is a comfort level in employees coming forward and saying, we found this, we need this to be investigated? You feel like they have a safe environment to do so?
Madam Chair, I do.
Okay. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hamm, you mentioned that the investigators, OIG investigators, brought forward they call it a draft or they call it findings or whatever. And to that point, then you asserted that it was too unbelievable to believe. What did you do at that point? Did you ask them for corroboration of their evidence? Did you ask them for a fact check? Did you ask them to restate the evidence, go back and check? And where does that stand?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we did that exactly that. They gave us additional information, and the OLA has that information as well as PFM. And so they're both evaluating it.
So, Ms. Hamm, the assertions initially brought to your attention that then, my assumption, were corroborated by the follow-on fact check. still asserted their initial claim. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I will have to wait until the OLA and PFM issue their reports.
But, Madam Chair, Ms. Hamm, what they claimed was happening was corroborated by the evidence that you had requested that they provide as backup to their initial claims. Was that received by you?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, it was received by DHS, not me specifically, and that's why we hired PFM, so that they can evaluate whether or not it is corroborated.
Ms. Hamm, I thought PFM was hired to find out whether or not the OIG was working correctly.
Uh-huh. Madam Chair, Representative Albright, they have a couple of missions. One was to look at the allegations and determine whether or not they were true. The second one is to look at what are best practices, what should we be doing in order to, that we maybe aren't doing already in order to best address child care fraud. So there's a phase one and a phase two.
Ms. Hamm, could you give me a kind of an overview in terms of the background of the people that are staffed on OIG? What are their credentials that would warrant or attract them to work for you based upon their background?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I assume that want specific...
Representative Albright, I believe you are meaning to ask her about qualifications of PFM.
No, actually, I'm trying to find out what I'm on what basis... She hires investigators at OIG.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, so I can tell you that with regard to our child care assistance provider unit, they are all former law enforcement. And in our CSRS area, we have a variety. We have some former law enforcement. We have some investigators that have worked for private companies. We have nurses, coders. We have an assortment.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hamm, for what purpose would it serve them to inflate or change the data they're providing to you other than that they have been called to serve their country or their state and to prevent fraud of the taxpayer dollar?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Ms. Hamm, do you trust the OIG investigators?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I trust their investigations.
But not in the case that is sitting before us today.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I do not trust the allegation that 50% of the CCAP money is being paid fraudulently.
Ms. Hamm, what would you believe?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, what I could believe is what we have proven. So if you wanted to take the 16 centers that we have closed, take that total that they were paid, take the total that was paid in CCAP for that time period, I would accept that as a percentage. It may be a different percentage, but I deal with facts and what we know. And so that is one that I would agree. But beyond that, we just have too small a sample.
Madam Chair, the same investigators that performed those audits are certainly investigating these, and so I find it highly improbable that she would accept the information and the conclusions drawn on those investigations, but not these, from the same people.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Ms. Hamm, PFM, I'm just wondering, what is the background in their... How are they able to do fraud investigations? Because just a simple Google search of PFM, it's an asset management and financial advice management group that says it's a dedicated asset managers and financial professionals helping our clients plan for their future. Is that?
Madam Chair, that must be a different PFM. I don't know a lot about them, but I can't imagine that that's the same PFM.
Where is your PFM located?
I don't know, but when you get the copy of the contract, you'll see it.
Representative Kresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Hamm, by the way. And I'm just going to, you're doing a great job. You're providing lots of information that's helpful to us. I'm going to try to just connect some dots because there's just some things and some gaps that I don't understand. One of the things, when you first started off, you mentioned that you're more interested in fact and not supposition. What allegations do you believe are rooted more in supposition than they are in fact?
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha, the fact that, or the opinion that it's 50%, that 50% of the CCAP money is fraud.
Okay, so one thing that you question is that it's 50% in fraud, Madam Chair. The second thing you had mentioned was that leadership has not been informed. Do you challenge that as supposition as well? Do you?
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha, I don't believe that DHS has ignored the concerns. I don't think that, to my knowledge, DHS has not interfered in any investigations. And, in fact, I can tell you I have directly asked my manager, has anyone ever told you to stand down on an investigation? And I was told no.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Hammond. Okay, so we, from your, the best of your knowledge, you'd like to see more that would suggest it's 50% before you could accept that as fact, and you believe that leadership has taken this as a sense of urgency. Now, the interesting thing of that, as I walk this through, we've heard from time and time again here, and not from you, but actually from my colleagues on the other side, who aren't here, by the way, which I find interesting, that it's not that big of a problem, or that to investigate this is more expensive than to actually uncover the fraud. And my question to you on this is, how can those be true when I see Mr. Nobles says there's a long line of convictions and that we know these cases exist, and then the OLA, Mr. Nobles' office, decided to add this to an already busy schedule, and then someone ordered the PFM group to help out with this? All of those seem to suggest to me a sense of urgency, which is contradictory to the comments that I've heard from the other side, which again aren't here, which were, oh, it's not that big of a deal. How do I reconcile that, those two statements?
Ms. Hamm.
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha, I can't speak to what the other side has said. I can tell you that it's definitely a serious problem, and we know that, and we're trying to figure out how we can get a handle on this because it is millions of dollars.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hamm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so what we can agree on is that fraud exists. We have a history of that. We can agree that it is a serious problem. What we don't seem to get our hands around is what is the acceptable level before this becomes urgent. If what I'm hearing now is it's urgent now, then the numbers you've indicated of 16 of 1,700 suggest the urgency level. That doesn't necessarily, so I want to make sure you clarify the statement. You don't believe it's the level of 50%. But you do believe the level we have today is urgent and should be dealt with?
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha, yes, I do. And if you look at this sheet that you have here from DHS, this also shows that DHS agrees. These are all the different changes that we have suggested and mostly gotten enacted to the program in direct response to concerns about fraud. So I don't think you'll find anybody saying it is not a serious problem. And we absolutely are committed to trying all effective methods to reduce it.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And this is not for you, Ms. Hamm. This is your points were right on there. I agree with your statement that I'll add it this way. Nobody should look at this and say it's not a serious problem. However, I see no colleagues on the other side over here, and I've heard in committee, I've heard these exact statements from leadership, this is not that big of a problem, and these are not your comments, or that the cost to do this outweighs the cost of the fraud. That directly contradicts with the actions that I've seen here of the OLA adding this to an already busy schedule, urgency within your area, and thank you for that, and DHS, and hiring an outside group, I just have to say to this committee that's very disturbing to me, that we can play that card of, oh, it's not that big of a deal, in fact, criticizing other members for not putting more money into the CCAP when we haven't already uncovered what this level is. My last thought on this, and I help me understand this, is I know the OLA reports come out with they uncover the practices to the best they can, where there are things, and they put out best practices. The PFM group, you've asked them to come out with best practices. What do you expect to be different here than might be in the OLA? Is it just the time frame and the difference?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, I have no idea if there will be differences. Hopefully they're consistent. It is more to do with the urgency and the timing of it.
And one follow-up. And thank you for that, Ms. Hamm. And so my follow-up would be, because that contract is directed by DHS, are they not going to be inclined to give the customer what they want and give them the right answers versus waiting for the OLA that could give the third party? I mean, someone's directing this on what we want from you versus the OLA, which is a true third party directing everyone else as to what, not what you want, but here's what you get.
Ms. Hamm.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, I think that's a little bit cynical. We hired a third-party entity in order to get an objective review, and I fully expect that many of the recommendations and findings will be very similar.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Kreisha.
Can I respond to one thing? Oh. Just very, very quick. I appreciate that. I think you could strike from the record me being cynical when, in fact, I just walked you through a whole bunch of contradictions. I'm just wondering because I tried to get $5 million, Madam Chair, for this last year for child welfare training, and I'm looking here at $66 million that I can't even get into. So I appreciate what you're saying. I don't think you meant it the way, and I didn't mean to strike it emotional. I'm just saying on this side of it, we have to uncover all these rocks because I don't know that everybody else is.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Many times in corporate America, when there is something nefarious going on in the public, corporations will hire an internal audit to kind of whitewash that and help save the corporation. And I certainly hope that is not happening with the state of Minnesota. Taxpayers certainly deserve the truth, and sometimes the truth is ugly, but in order to fix the problems, we have to get to the root of the problem, and honesty is the best policy. Miss Hamm, is there a Randall Bauer working for PFM on the investigation?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. So back to my question regarding PFM and being an asset management and financial firm. He indeed works for the same company, so who knew? Mr. Bauer's specialties include consulting, alternative finance, state and local governments. His background is with a CPA from Drake University. So I am wondering why a CPA and somebody that specializes in state and local governments and finance in an asset management firm would be up to the task of investigating the OIG and child care assistance fraud. How did PFM get the contract with being an asset management firm?
Madam Chair, I wasn't involved. I didn't select the contract. I'm sure we can get you some information about their qualifications. As I understand it, they have commonly performed audits of state functions, but I'm not familiar with the specifics.
Well, isn't that convenient? Sometimes I feel as if this agency no longer sees themselves as subject of oversight by the legislature and seem to do whatever they feel like they want to do because there is no repercussions. I don't think that an asset management firm is up to the task of investigating the due diligence that the OIG has already done. Does anybody else have any questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Hamm. I am just wondering, well, first I just want to clarify, it was very clear to me that counties implement the child care programs. However, DHS is the ultimate authority on regulating those things. And do you think the OIG would be more effective if they were not structured under DHS?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I feel that the current structure is works very well. We have autonomy. We have the ability to communicate very closely with DHS, with the DHS policy areas. So I don't see a need to change.
Okay. Madam Chair, it seems like most of the problems that we've seen are centered on a few counties like Hennepin and Ramsey. Have you looked at resources in those particular areas that we seem to have more problems?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, yes. So, for example, when we talked about FPI, that's the federal, or well, it's partly federal, partly state grant that we give to the counties. We fund many more investigators in Hennepin County than we do, you know, in Nobles County, in recognizing that there is a higher degree of fraud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one other quick comment. I just want to make sure through this process that we're not punishing the good providers. We heard a lot of testimony from providers across the state that are doing an excellent job and actually feel penalized by some of the oversight. And at the same time, we have all this fraud going on. So I just want to make sure that there's a happy balance there. And to also make sure that, you know, the OLA, thank you for your work. You are a very highly respected agency that is independent and not biased, and I believe both sides of the aisle respect the opinions that come out with the best practices and the reviews that you do. So thank you for your investigative work on that, and also thank you for your investigations that you're doing as well. Thank you.
All right. Does anybody else have any questions? Oh, Representative Albright.
Ms. Hamm, there was comment made about a disclaimer for signing up for a licensure about if any statements made here contrary to, you know, statements that you would be committing perjury. But yet that is included on the licensure form, and I'm wondering why.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I am not familiar with that. That's not the licensing form. It's the application for CCAP, and I don't know. I don't know if we have an answer right here, but we can certainly get you one if they don't.
Sorry, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Postine. I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Policy Program area at DHS. I'm not sure if they were referring to which CCAP billing form. There's a billing form, and then there's also the registration form. Each time a bill is submitted, there is language where the provider signs off that under penalty of law that providing false information is subject to civil and criminal proceedings. It doesn't use the word perjury. It just says providing false information, you will be subject to civil or criminal charges.
Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name right away.
Correct. Lori Postine.
Postine. What are those civil and criminal penalties? Are they enumerated anywhere?
Yes. In our policy manual, for example, we primarily talk about two. We do talk about working with your county attorney, for example, the fraud investigators in a county, or referring to the DHS OIG. But either way, there are disqualifications, which is a disqualification, and there's a hearing that can occur, or a provider can waive their right to a hearing and essentially be subject to a disqualification under CCAP. And then that is a more of an administrative procedure. And then otherwise, it goes to either, the county attorney or the DHS OIG decide which method, including possible criminal charges. So in terms of civil proceedings that are other than the disqualification hearing. I'd like to defer to you to see if you're aware of other, but those are the primary two methods that we refer to in our policy manual.
Okay. Anybody else have any further questions for Ms. Hamm? No? All right. Let's see. I just want to, Ms. Hamm, just give you a reminder that Friday we would like the RFP and the contract for PFM. Ms. Hamm? Okay. All right. Well, I believe we have... All right, we have Lori Posen up. Thank you for coming to the testifying table. We just want to review the CCAP provider reimbursement process. Specifically, we'd like to learn more about the nature of recent payment errors, the overpayment, underpayment correction process, and the notification process for stakeholders when mistakes occur. It came to attention a few weeks ago that providers... for some reason or another, did not get their child care assistance payments, and we just want to talk a little bit about that. We have Lori Posen up. She is the manager of the child care assistance program, and Deb Tipstra, the director of the application services of Minute. And please join us, or thank you for joining us at the testifying table today, and please state your name for the record and proceed when ready.
Hi, I'll just repeat my name. It's Lori Posen with the Child Care Assistance Program at DHS.
And I'm Deb Tipster. I'm the Director of Application Services for Minute Services, partnering with DHS.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if it's okay, I'll just read a summary that I have of the problem that was identified and what's been happening since then, and I will address issues about provider communication. So to give a brief overview, as installation was planned and prepared for applying the law to limit payments for when there's a secondary provider to 2 days in a biweekly period, that's the intended policy change that was going to occur on November 2nd. During that installation, a problem occurred. We discovered that via reports really from counties. That was a Friday. The following Tuesday, it was noted that there were likely payment mistakes or errors, miscalculations. That's the reason why payments were temporarily stopped. Always, counties and tribes that administer CCAP are in control of the payment timelines for CCAP. I'll just go over quickly what happened. The payments were stopped on a Tuesday, and by the following Wednesday, they were resumed. The law allows for 21 days for making payments. We do regret and apologize to providers who are often used to getting payments much quicker than 21 days. And, in fact, no payments did go out beyond the 21-day limit. But we understand that any break in the routine can cause a problem for providers. The payments, there were 4.5 business days that payments didn't go out of because essentially DHS just communicated with counties and gave some talking points to providers because, again, typically the county controls how long a payment might take because it's their staff who make the approvals. We did ask them to hold the payments while we determined the scope and size of this issue about possible incorrect payments, which I'll get to in a minute. The intended policy change did not happen correctly. A really inadvertent capping issue and registration fee issue did occur, which was causing some mistakes in some payments. Though that was the issue that came to light, and so the best answer at the time was, let's just halt payments, which has never occurred since there's been a statewide system since 2009. And then I said for five business days, those payments did just not get processed. And so the issues that were identified were, again, two, a weekly payment cap was not being applied properly in some instances, and registration fees were not being paid, essentially underpaid. And so when we identified those two problems, quickly Minute came and consulted with us, and we started on the path of what would it take to fix those, and then we diligently worked together to make that happen. At that point, we let counties know again that we would be, we were seeking a quick solution, and that they could tell providers that there may be a delay in payments. I'll tell you what the scope of the problem was found was that about no more than 250 registration fees statewide were underpaid, and those have now been, the data has been given to the counties so that they can correctly make those payments, and counties are following through with correcting the underpayments. The overpayment issue was a subset of payments and applied to no more than 975 providers, and the amount was between $20 and $110 of the sample that we've pulled in those cases. We have not finished analyzing the data to see what the total scope of that issue is. But it was a relatively small amount of the total payments that was issued during this time when incorrect payments went out, and we are working to identify those down, you know, to the exact amount, but we have not yet gotten to that point. Lastly, I want to say that, there's actually two things. We are working on, still working with Minute on the intended policy change that was to occur with the system automating, limiting payments to secondary providers, and that is being worked on as we speak, and that will continue to correctly apply the policy that was going to apply November 2nd using the system. There has been a system workaround to apply the law correctly. So regarding provider communications, as I mentioned, this statewide request to counties and tribes to hold making payments has never occurred because there's never been a problem in the 9 years since there's been, or I'm sorry, yeah, 9 years, since there's been a statewide system. So we had not considered having a quick provider notification method. We've done postcards with providers when, policy changes have occurred where we have a lot of advance notice to do mailings or postcards, but we don't routinely communicate with providers in any electronic fashion. That being said, as this issue came to light and we looked over the weekend after this had occurred, what are our possibilities for reaching providers? We did determine that we had a number of emails held in our data warehouse, the counties collect emails, and so we took those, and then we also tapped into a listserv that the licensing unit manages that goes to more providers than are paid by CCAP. And so between those two sets of data that we had, we did, on the day the payment issue was resolved, Wednesday, November 14th, we did let providers know that the payment issue had been resolved. But until then, we had never, like I said, had a need, and so we hadn't pondered, what are our options for quickly reaching providers, and we weren't confident of what our abilities were until we took a few days to look into those options. So in the future, we will set up a listserv that will be more automated so that we can quickly reach, grab the emails that we have and reach providers in a more systematic way. So with that, I'll stop and see if you either have questions for myself or Ms. Tipstra.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Posine, I was just curious, did Minute do the initial programming for the policy change?
Representative Peterson, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad to hear that you, because we carried legislation to increase the communication and transparency to providers, so I'm glad that you put that together, although it seemed to be a little after the fact. But, yeah, communication has been an issue moving and obviously will continue to be, and then also communication to us as legislators, because it's difficult when we're getting providers contacting us about payment issues and we don't know anything about it. So along with communicating with the providers, you might want to let us know too. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that, Representative Peterson. Alerting your legislators that this would be a good idea, because quickly we can communicate that out to our provider network as well. And many of them are very active on social media, so all it takes is a post, or even if DHS could make a post on their social media account a little quicker than trying to find email addresses, too, sometimes. Does anybody have any additional questions? Yep. All right. Does the audience have any questions or would like to testify on anything? All right, seeing one coming up. Thank you, ladies, for your time and coming forth today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Elizabeth Bangard. I'm the owner and director of Huey Grohl Early Childhood Center. Spent over 30 days here this past session and drove over 4,000 miles. I'm starting to wonder if you ever get tired of being lied to your face by state agencies. Because I can tell you as a child care provider that they don't actually check attendance records. It's not a thing. My licensor came, actually two, because I'm being targeted now by the lovely Department of Human Services, and I videotaped them, both of them. First it was, oh, well, this is supervisor here to watch the licensor to see how she's doing. Then they saw I had a GoPro camera, and it turned into, well, let's just expedite this process and split up. So then I brought out my second GoPro camera. Spoiler alert, I have multiple. Then, when it came time to go to the paperwork things, they demanded that I turn off my camera, which I did, but turned my phone on and started recording, because I'm not dumb. What they do when they ask for attendance records is they ask you to pull them out, and then you pull them out, and then you hold them up like this, and they're like, okay, yep, looks good. They don't look at names, they don't look at times, they don't look at any of that. In the last 5 years that I've been opened, I've been audited twice by the Department of Human Services regarding county assistance. What happens is they send you a name of a child, they send you a date range of the attendance that they're looking for. You must scan the documents in within a certain time frame and send them in. And that is how you get audited. Now, you might ask, I wonder what happens in the time frame in between if people are trying to fraudulently bill. Could they perhaps create attendance records? I bet they can. I would like to know, aside from the 16 centers out of the over 1,700 centers that there are, how many they actually just popped in on and how many they went in only after someone tipped them off, which means if you do basic math, there's still another over 1,600 centers out there doing who knows what with our tax dollars. So as a taxpayer and as a child care provider, I'm kind of over it. We have multiple loopholes in this state. I could easily give a list of probably 10 FOIA requests that would be pulled, but it's pretty much a moot point because we all see what happens when people like Representative Dean pull them. No one cares. They think they're above the law. And the problem is that CCAP doesn't just fund private providers. It funds Head Start. So here's a loophole example from my center. We have a center I'll call Child A. Child comes to Here We Grow, is there for about 15 minutes, gets on a bus, goes to Head Start. Public school goes over to Head Start, provides special education to said child at Head Start. Child gets back on a bus from Head Start, comes back to Huey Grove, spends about 3 or 4 hours with us, and then goes home. I can legally bill as a 4-star parent aware rated center for up to 10 hours of care. Doesn't matter if they're for 1 minute, they're in attendance for 1 minute. Doesn't matter if they're in attendance for 10 hours or the entire time I'm open, because that is a loophole that was created, in my opinion, to sustain government programs. Now, here's a fun fact. This child was kicked out of Head Start because they didn't have an iron sample that was needed, because apparently that's something Head Start gathers now, blood work from children. So, yeah, So then, this child's not receiving services for Head Start. Then the public school gets involved and tells me they are going to bus the child. So now the public school is busing the child to Head Start on taxpayer dollars because supposedly Head Start ran out of funding for busing. I would like someone to pull a FOIA request on how much of the Child Care Assistance Program dollars go into Head Start and public school programs, because in 2016, through a little loan loophole, there's something called braided funding that occurs. The braided funding occurs when public schools can partner with Head Starts, and you know, I could just never figure out why all these Head Starts popped up in 2017. I could not figure it out. And then a little loophole of braided happened in 2016, and a wonder of wonders. Look where those Head Starts opened, right in the same school districts where referendums failed their public preschool programs to open. Shocking. Our tax dollars are funding public programs that are already state and federally funded, amongst other things. And the Office of the Legislative Auditor, who I asked to meet with in April of 2017 and spent over an hour with, and provided a nifty little color-coded sheet that was confusing even for them to understand about all of these loopholes tracking all of these kids through all of these programs, shows exactly what their report is stating. These public programs aren't being held to any standard at all. Meanwhile, I have to submit all of my attendance records and everything, not only to the county, but also to Parent Aware, either Pathway 1 or Pathway 2, which is a whole other train wreck. So I better not hear a single person from the absent administrative member, who's conveniently not here today, ask for any more of my tax dollars to fund a child care assistance program, because all it's doing is funding Head Start and the public school. How convenient that half of this table is empty, and how convenient that no one wants to answer my questions. And I'd like to go on record that state, because I am afraid of the Department of Human Services targeting me. If you think I have time on my hands now, and you shut me down, I will have even more time. I'm tired of wearing chapstick, dealing with them, and kissing people's behinds. This is our tax dollars, these are our children, and quite frankly, I would like to know how Carolyn Hamm has a job.
All right, we got one more member from the public coming up. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Baker.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Representative Franson, yes. My name is Wes Lund. I wasn't going to say anything today, and then when I noted the activity in the audience that occurred while this individual, whomever that is, who got up to speak, she's the only person in this room apparently who has any direct contact with the actual CCAP program in terms of providing services to youngsters directly. And all of a sudden there's social networking going on in the back, there's sidebar conversations. This is the person who should be front and center today. This is the person the cameras should be on. She's telling you how the program operates from the inside. And the attitude projected toward her is one of incredible disrespect. Is there anyone in the state office here who has any direct contact with a kid? Where did what's-her-name go? Okay, now I'm a taxpayer, and my part of this is to say thank you for being the stewards of our taxes. I'm surprised the other side isn't present here at all. After all, I have heard the disses in the press when they say that there is no problem. I've heard that over and over again. There isn't a problem. This is being overestimated. It's being blown out of proportion. There's lies. There's assertions of racism going on. I don't understand all of that. We're talking about some money and where it's being spent. I don't mind paying my taxes because that's the price I pay for civilization. But I want it to service the deserving. I want it to go to the people who deserve these programs and not to go wherever the heck they think it's going. Please look into this, and I thank you for following up on this. This was all spur of the moment. I didn't know I was going to speak, but when you've got someone like this who's an actual child care provider, everyone in the DHS should turn their cell phones off and stop the sidebar conversations and listen. Pardon me. Thank you, Madam Secretary, or Ms. Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. All right. Does anybody else in the audience have anything to add? Okay. Members? All right. Well, that completes our agenda today. I am very sad, though, that our other side of the aisle did not come to today's hearing. This is tax dollars that we are discussing here, and today was a very important day in shedding some light into our state government. Representative Flanagan, she is our lieutenant-elect. What a no better person than to carry this message to the governor and to the next set of commissioners about maybe being better stewards of our tax dollars. But sadly, she is not here either. Hopefully she will listen to the testimony along with the other members of the aisle. Members, please see our committee legislative assistant, Mary McNamara, before you leave the hearing room so that you can sign the meeting minutes before you leave. And I want to thank everyone for their attendance and even those left in the crowd today. Thank you for sticking with us these past few hours. It's been exciting. And members and audience, the meeting is adjourned.